You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories.
And welcome to episode 337. And in this one, I chat with Jeff, who has kindly agreed to share his story with us. We discuss depression, spending 20 years with a traditional psychoanalyst who did not help recognize OCD within him, the red flags of this therapy for Jeff, realizing that there are different schools or types of therapy, and the trauma caused by this particular therapeutic relationship. We then discuss how he eventually found a therapist that was really helpful for him and other therapists since then. We discuss Jeff getting a cancer diagnosis. We talk about ethics in therapy, what's helped him in his journey, doing movement therapy, and much, much more. And I really respect and appreciate Jeff for opening up about his experiences in this unhelpful therapeutic relationship. And if you guys find yourself in a similar situation, hopefully this episode helps you in some way. And thank you to NoCD for supporting the podcast. NoCD offers affordable, effective, and convenient therapy available in the US and outside the US. To find out more about NoCD, their therapy plans, if they currently take your insurance, or to download their free app, head over to go.treatmyocd.com/theOCDstories, or the link will be in the episode description. And thank you as always to you guys for listening. I deeply appreciate it. And without further ado, here is Jeff.
Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thank you, Stu. Do you like Stu or Stuart?
Either's fine by me.
Okay. Thank you, Stuart. It's nice to be here. It's very nice to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. So, as you know, it'd be good to hear your OCD story or story, and you can share as little or as much as you want to.
Okay, sounds good. My first recollection of having OCD was second grade. We had to read a story, and then the teacher asked us to summarize it, and I kind of panicked. And as I'm writing it, I couldn't leave things out. I kept adding more and more. I think my summary was longer than the actual story. And I knew I wanted to summarize it, and I couldn't. So growing up, I was taught that my value was based on my intellect. I did well in school, and I was a good boy. And I was not valued for who I am, just because that's, you know, you're you, and we love you, and that's great. That's how it should be. That didn't happen. My mother was a narcissist, so I really had to look after her emotional needs. So when I was trying to summarize this, I couldn't write it in my own words because no one had asked that of me ever, even in second grade. So I kept thinking, well, if I put this in, it will show them that I'm smart. And that kind of, that's sort of the basis of my OCD. My OCD takes a form of ruminating, and it's endless. And it can be if I'm typing an email or working on a project. My whole being is geared to how can I make this better? Because if it's better, then it's foolproof. And I will be loved. I'll show everyone how good I am, how talented I am. And the idea that it might not be so good is very painful to me. And I avoid that at any cost. As a result, I either don't start projects, I avoid them, or I start it and I don't finish it, because to finish it is making a definitive statement and saying, this is me, and I'm presenting it to the world. It's actually not me, but that's kind of OCD, as if it is, and it's not. Yeah. And so I can spend endless hours ruminating like that over and over, what can I do to make it better? Can it be brighter, darker, bolder, more contrast? I'm a visual artist, so you know, more saturation, this style, that style, and it's endless. It literally goes on forever. And it's pain. It's absolute nightmare. So when I got to college, I got very depressed. I couldn't finish my projects. My work was good, but I couldn't finish anything. And the depression really took hold then. And so I went to a therapist there, eventually supported myself waiting tables and moved to New York and transferred to NYU. But I was still very depressed. So it sort of repeated the same pattern. So I went to find a therapist, and I found one here in New York, and it was, it went very badly. I didn't know there were different kinds of therapy. It turned out just by chance that this person she's considered an old guard, authoritarian kind of therapist, even by her peers. And I have no idea how she could not recognize this. I mean, I do, but I went there for an extremely long time. It was over 20 years. And she did not recognize that I had OCD. Now, I related all the stories, the one I just told you from second grade, also about college, not being able to finish my work, plus things that happened in real time while I was seeing her. Never a mention of it. To her, I think she thought this was just the choice that I was being. I really don't know what she thought, because she never talked about it. Occasionally, she would say, well, maybe you're very anxious. Why don't you ask your psychiatrist about that? And her type of therapy was psychodynamic psychoanalysis, which I found out after leaving from various sources, is the worst thing you can do for someone who has OCD. It's backed up by the IOCDF. On their site, there are some links to studies about it. The NIH here in the States has some documents about that. Dr. Stephen Phillipson, who you know, he talks about it on his site. And I would tell her, I'm tired of hearing myself talk about the same thing over and over. And she would say, it's okay. Just keep talking. That was her treatment. There was no goal other than she felt I needed to get in touch with my anger. And I really don't know what that meant. To this day, I still really don't. After years and years, I said, tell me, please, what I need to do differently, because I'm not getting in touch with my anger. Surely I thought she would have a suggestion for me, but she didn't. She said, just keep talking. That was always her response. But we as clients don't have endless time to just keep talking. There were things she said from the very beginning that I knew were strange, that I knew were odd, such as the first thing she said to me was, it was the first session, you can say anything you want here, you can't hit me, and you can leave the treatment when we both decide you can leave the treatment. So I knew then that was really strange. It's my treatment. And I'm paying for it. You know, what does that even mean? But I didn't say anything. There were other odd things she would say. Early on, she said, when you interrupt me, don't, and her voice became very childlike. It was very weird. When you interrupt me, don't you think you're trying to control me? And I thought that was odd because I was just talking. I said, well, no, I'm trying to talk. The fact that she felt that me talking was an interruption to her is odd. And the fact that she thought I was trying to control her was very strange. So I brought up my concerns about the treatment, about it not working many, many times. And she had various tactics that she used, excuses or diverting away, ways to avoid talking about it. So she really never addressed the fact that the treatment was failing and I was not getting better. It was clearly getting worse. My friends knew it. They saw it. My friends brought it up to me. My accountant mentioned it to me because I was paying a third of my income for this treatment, which is a huge amount.
Because you would have been going many times a week, right, with psychoanalysis?
Yes. Yeah. I went 5 times a week. Mm. And it was too much. I didn't need that. And I couldn't afford it. But I really thought, I mean, I knew I needed therapy, and I did. So I was willing to do what it took. But what I didn't know was there were different kinds of treatment. There were different ideologies, different way of approaching it and looking at it. And I didn't know I had OCD. So I thought this was it. I thought if I went somewhere else, it would be the same thing. Plus, because I was brought up to be very kind of intellectual, I just ate up the whole idea of I'll go 5 times a week. And, you know, she was very kind of faux intellectualized. And I told her that too. I said, you know, I need you to help me feel because I find myself repeating things you've said to me outside of here and it has no meaning to me. But she couldn't do that. Whereas my later therapist, who I saw after her, he knew what to do in a session. If I were to start ruminating and going off on a tangent, he would bring me back. He said, let's come back to, because he knew what was emotional, the core of what I should be talking about and where I just am going off all over the place. So he would bring me back. And that was really important and very helpful. Even my primary care physician said, this has been going on for a long time. Why don't you look into some clinical trials, which I did. And for two reasons, various reasons. One was for ketamine and one was for TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation. The first one I could have done, but it was very early and I thought I wouldn't be able to get back in time for work. Okay. And that was really an OCD loop. And if she had addressed that I had OCD, I'm sure I could have worked around that. And the ketamine, my blood pressure was a little high, so that didn't work out. So eventually a friend said to me, I don't think this is working. You know, this person is not helping me. And the first time she said it, I thought, oh no, you don't understand. And then I remember years later, I was talking to someone and she asked me, how's your therapist? And I said, oh, she's terrific. It's great. And as those words came out of my mouth, I knew that it wasn't true. I didn't feel it. But that was part of the problem. I had been brought up to not value my own feelings and thoughts. And this was a repeat of that. unfortunately, this person needed that kind of attention from the treatment. I would come in with ideas, very excited about connections I had made. And I noticed that she would say, no, you're wrong. I noticed that the happier I was going into a session, the more resistance I would get from her. And I brought it up to her and she said, I am the analyst. And it was like being in therapy, having a child as, you know, having a child as the therapist who's throwing a little tantrum each time. She just would not go there. She wouldn't go to the place of looking at the treatment objectively. Is it helping me or not? Yeah. And clearly it was not. So eventually my friend brought it up to me again, and this time it sort of made sense to me. And I brought it up to my therapist. I said, you know, you've been telling me for a long time that the treatment's been working, which she did, and that, oh, just keep talking. One day you'll feel better. And that day was not coming. It never came. So I said, what's going on? She didn't like that very much. And she tried the usual things, but I think once she realized that I was not going to be obsequious anymore, her words got more aggressive and adversarial, but really not different than any other time during the treatment, but much nastier in a way. And that was very hard because I really thought I could find some humanity because I was really asking a real question. And suddenly I was a blamer in her eyes, and it's not my fault that I've had a terrible life. It's not her fault, she said. It's not my fault you've had a terrible life. I don't know who says that to another person. And throughout the whole treatment, she would say things like, well, you're indulgent, you're inflexible, maybe you don't want to be helped. So it was really awful. So I left and I realized that all those years of being told that this is working were for nothing. It had been a waste. I hadn't progressed at all. I got much worse. And so I fell into despair and it was extremely dark. My depression was always bad and the OCD was a nightmare, but I never knew a place this dark existed. And it lasted every day. The feelings lasted every day for a year and a half before they started to subside. So I had two friends that helped me through those months tremendously. By just supporting me, by being there for me, checking in on me, telling me about sharing their experiences with me. And eventually they said, maybe you should think about getting back into therapy. So I did. And I found a therapist, David D'Alessio, here in Manhattan. And I found him through NIP. It's a training institute. And this institute was formed specifically as a reaction to the kind of therapy I had had, which was a kind of Freudian analytical therapy that goes on forever and doesn't really work. And David gave me what I had never had before, which was a safe place. He was rock solid for me. He was always there. He was very present. He looked at my issues straight on with me. He didn't flinch. He was honest with me. And that gave me a foundation that fortified me. And I had never had that before. And I was in very bad shape. And then in 2016, I had a cancer diagnosis. So that compounded everything even more so. He hadn't even graduated yet when I met him. I've come to realize, I think there are very few therapists who would have been willing to do what he did. And it's tremendous how he helped me. So he's the one that told me I had OCD. He showed me a video. It's on the site, The Mighty. And it's extraordinary. It's 3 minutes. Director put it together. And I think it's called What It's Like to Be in My Head for 3 minutes. And it starts with him waking up, getting out of bed, and the thoughts. So he verbalized his thoughts and then overlapped the thoughts on the track. And it's a constant barrage of, did I sleep enough? Am I going to have a heart attack? Did I take my medicine? Did I take too much medicine? It goes on like that for 3 minutes. And I looked at it and I started to cry because I thought, that's me. I was really angry at first because it was hard to look at. And I was angry at David. But then I was thankful because I didn't feel alone anymore. And now I had kind of a name to my difficulty. Up till then, you know, my analyst had kind of intuited that it's just I'm being difficult. I'm not logically thinking things out properly. And that, you know, OCD is not a logic disorder. So that was the start of a recovery for me, or learning a pathway to learn. And I have to say, I'd say most of what I've learned, I have learned from your podcast, listening to therapists, listening to people like myself. And that's invaluable. Yeah, so having OCD is a nightmare. The first job I had should have taken me about 3 hours. And I remember ruminating about a term that they wanted me to do. And I kept redoing it, thinking, well, this isn't right. And I kept redoing it. For the next 12 hours, I stayed up all night, and you know, it was horrible. And the result I ended up with was not different than what I had started out. Yeah. So now I try to approach it as, well, I don't have to make this better. Because better for me is just different. I'm trying to please all these imaginary people. So that's afforded me some time, you know, that I can starting to do tasks in a more appropriate amount of time. So after David, I saw him for about 4 or 5 years, and then I needed to change for a financial reason. So I saw a specialist, a psychiatrist at Mount Sinai, who was terrific. And we worked on CBT. And there was a point where after 2 months, I felt we were spinning. I was spinning my wheels. And I think we were both frustrated. And I brought it up to him. And he said, you know, this is the way I work. I may not be able to work in the way you need. And I left that session feeling, oh, this is it. This is it. He's not going to, he just can't do it. He doesn't want to do it. And I remember being very upset. And the next session I came back and he just shifted. He said, okay, let's try it this way. So we would kind of just talk for half of the session, and then we'd do some CBT techniques the second half. But I really appreciated that he was willing to look at the treatment and see what worked and what didn't work, and modulate with me, because my analyst had not been able to do that. It was only her way. And she was not attuned to, the only way I think she could not know I had OCD is if she was not actively knowledgeable, keeping up with information. Yeah. And another person at her institute, and there's an article, and he brings that up there, that the old guard seems to be not interested in contemporary thought. Because if you heard my stories, the ones even that happened in real time, you can't miss it. So that psychiatrist helped me tremendously. I wanted to talk maybe a little bit about ethics.
Yeah.
Because there's a little bit of a myth about ethics. And I'll talk about my experience with it in New York State. Because when I left that treatment, I wanted to seek out avenues to perhaps hold her accountable, because she really had caused me trauma. And there was not a lot of information online. I'm not sure if there is more now, but there are three avenues one can take here in the States: a lawsuit, or filing with the state ethics, the board, or the institute, where if the therapist belongs to an institute, they have an ethics committee. And finding a lawyer is very difficult. There are very few in the States that specialize in this law practice. So what I realized is you would need to find a lawyer who would be willing to take the case on. And what I didn't know is that a lawyer needs time to prepare. So you need to give them a lot of time to prepare, which means finding someone sooner than later, because there is a statute of limitations.
Okay.
As far as the state, there was a New York Times article that talked about it a few years ago. A woman had filed a complaint about her psychiatrist. And it is kind of shrouded in mystery, as this article points out. You file the complaint, and maybe 9 months, a year later, you get a response. It's very hard to find information about how the state works, how they use the information. But their response was there was evidence of ethical violations by my therapist, but not enough to win in a court of law. So I was pretty disheartened by that. I kind of understood the nature of therapy as there are two people in the room. So it's hard, really. It's nearly impossible to have, evidence. But I did send a complaint to the ethics committee of the institute where she belongs as a member of, and they're one of the older, more conservative institutes in the city. And I really thought they would do something, because they have an aspirational model, because it's fully in their power to hear your story and make a decision. Their decision was they said, we're going to abide by the state. We're going to just say whatever they said is fine with us. And I was pretty upset by that. I was pretty upset by that because the state didn't invite them to abide by their ruling. There's no mandate that says they have to abide by the state. There's no law that says that. So they also had a piece of information that said that the state said there were no there were no ethical violations. And I pointed out to them that that's not what the state told me. And they ignored that information. They didn't respond. They actually, my initial complaint, they did not respond either. I found out that that was a pattern. I had to follow up 2 weeks later. Then I gave them a response. Their response was pretty upsetting to me. And I waited 2 years, and just recently I revisited it with them. I wanted to know that in relating this story that I had an ending, that I knew that I went a little further and said, hey, you know, the information I gave you was very clear, both what happened to me, her treatment that is exacerbates OCD, and the information you have from the state, I have information that says that, no, that's not accurate. And I'd like you to correct that, because their decision, the Institute's decision, sends out a message to therapists. You know, their job is, their ethics committee, their job is to uphold ethics.
Yep.
And they decided, we're not going to say anything. Because that's what they did. They ignored me. They didn't respond, except to say, we received your complaint. I had to follow up again, and they said, I finally had to ask them, are you going to do anything? They said, no, we are not going to take any action. And I thought that was, I implored them, this is really what you're there for, you know, to uphold ethics. Otherwise, you're just for show. You know, you have a committee, but you're not doing anything. And I said, I understand you're an institute, but you really, it's important to do what you feel is right in your heart. And it's fully within their power to make a decision like that. Plus, it's their obligation if they have an ethics committee. So I was, you know, disillusioned by that, but not as much as the first time, because I was expecting it.
Yeah.
So I just think it's important, because I think therapists believe that there is an avenue for clients to pursue. So you could say there's an avenue, but they're not functional. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't function. If the people don't want to make a decision, then there's really nothing there. And one therapist said to me, there are no protections for consumers in this industry. And I found that to be true. So I'd love to talk about things that worked for me, that have worked. So CBT does work. Some of the ideas, thought records have worked when I really try to make a decision and I just keep going back and forth and back and forth and writing down. My favorite one is pros and cons. Pros of doing something, cons of doing something. The pros of not doing it and the cons of not doing it. And that's given me clarity. And something I really love, and I fought this for a long time, is affirmations. So I have a therapist now, Christopher McCarthy, and he's great with, we work on CBT, and he's great with giving me, worksheets and things I can do when I'm stuck. And so he had mentioned affirmations, and I resisted it because the ones I had heard were things like, I am wonderful, I'm fine just how I am. And I don't believe that I am fine the way I am. And I understand the reason for saying that, but I needed to tailor it so that it felt right for me. So I finally did that. And I wrote down things that were appropriate, especially for a situation I was in at the time. And I started saying them, and I found after a short amount of time, it helped quite a lot. And I think the reason is that when I'm ruminating, it's all negative. Like, I need to make this better because it's not good enough the way it is. If I don't make it better, I will look foolish. I'm unworthy. People will see I'm a fraud. There's not a lot of room in my head for positive thoughts. So by saying the rumination, the affirmations out loud in front of a mirror, they become alive a little bit. And now I have the experience of a new thought in my head. And it helped me a lot because when I'd be stuck in a moment, suddenly one of my affirmations would come into my mind, which had not been there before. And I was able to access it somewhat. And one of them was, I don't have to give my power away. I was co-leading a workshop with three other people. And one of the participants was very, she didn't take social cues. She didn't see them very well. So she would interrupt a lot and kind of give opinions and information rather than ask questions. And I wasn't the only one that felt that, but it was important for me. We had a lot of information to cover. And so I would say that before the workshops to myself in front of the mirror, because I had given my power away many times during my, in my life. And so that was helpful. It was helpful to be able to say something when that she started to interrupt in a very kind way. I didn't want to humiliate her. So I made sure I prepared what I might say. And that was very helpful. And I started doing them again, and it's been good. The other thing that I do is I work with a movement psychotherapist here in the city. Okay. Her name's Carla Felchu. And when I went to her website, I knew I wanted to do something with movement. The reason is that years ago, after I left this bad analysis, I took some kettlebell classes, some training. This really interesting guy, Jose. He was a chef and a strong man, and he could rip a deck of cards in half. I never saw him do it, but he was very interesting. And so the first time we were going to do it, I had to kind of lift it up and then let go of it and grab it with the other hand and then swing it down between my legs. And I was so afraid I was going to drop it, smash the cement floor of the studio I was renting, and then have to pay thousands of dollars to have it repaired. And I'm sure this was going to happen. And then I realized, you know what? I can do this. Like, deep down, I kind of knew I could do it. And I did it. And what I noticed was that trying to make that kind of compound movement, I'm focusing on that. There's not a lot of space to give to ruminating. Yeah. So I thought some kind of movement would be helpful for me. And on Carla's website, it says, if you've had a lot of talk therapy and you're still stuck, this could be helpful for you. So her treatment's been really, really extraordinary on different levels. And one of the exercises we do is, if I'm overwhelmed, if I'm ruminating and I'm feeling overwhelmed, it's kind of a grounding exercise, movement. And it does relax me and center me. And I found that, you know, ruminating, it's spending so much time in my head, and it almost feels disembodied. You know, in front of a computer, and it's just going on and on and on. And I lose connection with myself in a certain way, because it's this loop. It's playing by itself in a way. And the work we do isn't always movement. Sometimes it's saying something with the movement. And it sort of gives me a new dialogue. And sitting in front of the computer, I'm in the same posture all day long. And there's not a lot of expression. And I think just the thinking and the gets stuck in the embodiment of not moving, that posture. So moving makes the energy and my thoughts come alive more. And it gives it solidity. You know, I can feel it rather than it being some distant rumination off in the ether. And also, yeah, so that's been really profound for me.
Yeah, I think it's so important, movement practice. And if it can be entangled with psychotherapy, then great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also saying things out loud. It's different when you think it, and it's different when you say it.
Yeah.
It's very different. Because often I've thought of things so many times, but when I tried to verbalize it, it didn't come out right away. And we do exercises about, like, if I'm upset with something or situation, we might move and say, well, where would you want to put this thing that's giving you trouble? Like, well, I don't know. What do you mean? So, well, you can put it anywhere in the room. So I made a portal on the wall. You know, that's where one thing went. Then I was stuck with another thing. She said, well, it doesn't have to stay in the room. So I said, okay, I'll put it outside the window on the sidewalk. Or I'll make this one really small and put it in the corner. So there are different things we do that help, but also the interacting with someone it's not sitting down. It's not talking. It's more active. And there's a kind of learning to follow and learning to lead, which has been very helpful for me because I spent a lot of time just following. So it's given me some agency, which it seems that some of the OCD specialists talk about, you know, that we have a choice, that when we're stuck or thoughts are coming into our mind that we would rather not be there, that we do have an agency to make a decision to not engage in it or make better choices. I have used, so Michael Greenberg's been on your podcast.
Yeah.
And I really did like what he said about not engaging in the thoughts. And it's really hard to do, because these aren't things that are easy to not engage with, because we have an attachment with them. At least I do with my thoughts. Right? The attachment is, if I don't ruminate and keep making this better, it's going to be catastrophic, because who am I? But I have been able to do it at sometimes because I really didn't know what else to do. And the urge is to keep going and make it better. And I say, no, I'm just not going to listen to that. And that did free me up, free me up to work faster and not worry Because if I don't engage in the rumination, then I'm free. Then I can create and not worry about what someone else might think. And then I can create the next thing and move on, move further along, and create more. And the other thing that's helped me somewhat is, to my surprise, acupuncture. Okay. So I have two sleep disorders, which also make it difficult to treat the OCD, you know, along with the depression, because I get like 10 minutes of REM sleep, whereas most people get 2 hours. So I'm always pretty exhausted. And so I tried acupuncture because one of my sleep disorders is periodic limb movement disorder. They don't know a lot about it. And there were some studies that said acupuncture can help. And I remember laying on the table thinking, my mind was racing. And I thought, well, this is just one more thing that's not going to help me. And suddenly I felt very calm and kind of happy. And I was totally taken back by that. So I've continued with that for several months. And what I did find is that it gave me a reserve that I had not experienced before. And it gave me a reserve of energy to face the day. So it didn't make my depression disappear or the OCD disappear, but I felt I had a fortification where, okay, now I can utilize the things that I've learned to help manage the OCD and the depression, which before the acupuncture, that didn't happen. So it's been positive for me.
Yeah, that's amazing to hear. And yeah, I'm glad you tried all these different things as well to find what works for you as an individual. Well, at first, you know, sorry you kind of went through such a long period of bad analysis.
Thank you.
It sounds really tough, and no wonder you kind of have trauma as a result of that. I'm sure the body movement therapy is helping with that.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I think just to add, like, yeah, the complaints and ethics department for a traditional old school psychoanalytical institute is probably not, I predict, is as you've said it is. So like the governing body I'm with in the UK take complaints very seriously, and they investigate it. And so I think the more modern therapies, the complaints departments will do that, hopefully. But for some of the more traditional, we're the experts, you're the patient, you know.
Yeah,
maybe it's going to be much more turbulent. But the thing that I found interesting about the psychoanalysis piece is when you talked about your mother and her narcissism, and you having to kind of keep her happy or her emotional needs met, it almost feels like it's paralleled now in this female analyst who was felt quite narcissistic to me, and how she treated you and gaslit you when you showed that you had needs, you know, even though you're paying to be there. And
absolutely.
And you then, I guess what came to my mind is a small, very small silver lining is that you ending it with her may have been some kind of way of you taking control back over your mother or the history of your mother. Or maybe now I'm being a psychoanalyst, but
no, that's a really, really observant point. Because one of the things I've been thinking about recently is that I started to wonder if my OCD, the ruminating, also served as, you know, okay, I need this to be perfect and better, so I'll be loved. But the ruminating also served to, not see that my mother was, I know she did the best she could, but she was a very bad mother. She caused a lot of pain in my family, and also my analyst, who I do think was a narcissist. It's hard to see those in people we, you know, love or care about, or in a relationship that we thought was better than it is. So I think that's a really good observation, because that's when I started to feel like I had some agency to do what I need to do.
Yeah, to put your needs first, you know, and yeah, end that toxic relationship in the case of the therapy. And then, you know, you found a therapist that was really good for you. Probably would have been very healing and relieving probably to finally find them. So then you've really kind of been on a journey with all these other therapies, and you've had good therapists, feels like, since that time.
Yes.
Where would you say you're at now, like day to day? How much does it bother you and that type of stuff?
It still bothers me a lot. It's very hard because of the sleep disorder depression. It's interesting, the past couple weeks, I've been able to at times work faster and not listen to the rumination, not engage in it, not answer the question, how can I make this better? Just say, you know what, this is fine, because it's not going to make a difference in my life. It's a better choice for me to move on. But it's still very hard, and I don't always succeed at managing that. I do have a ways to go. I'm not sure what the next step will be for me. Maybe it's ERP. Maybe EMDR. Maybe creative arts therapy. These are things I don't know much about, but because it's not managed for me. My OCD is still enough that it causes a lot of pain.
Yeah. Okay. Well, look, ERP is, as you know, is one of the most researched for OCD. So it probably can't hurt to give it a try. Right. And the good thing about it is just give it a couple months and see what happens. Mm-hmm. You should get a gauge of whether there's some effect to it or not in that time. And then, EMDR, maybe for the trauma, whether it's the trauma of the analyst or trauma of other past stuff.
Right.
And, creative arts, you're a creative person, so that may help tap into some stuff for you as well. And you can do creative arts in, like, group therapy as well. You know,
that would be helpful. Actually.
And it's cheaper too that way. So, yeah, okay. So, yeah, lots of avenues to go down and consider. So I guess, words of hope for anyone listening with their OCD, like what would you want them to know or tell them?
I would want them to know that the reason that we are questioning and wondering and in therapy is because we do have a sense of ourselves. A strong sense, a positive sense, a caring, compassionate sense that sometimes gets, at least for me, got very buried over time with bad analysis. But the OCD makes it hard to think clearly because it's so painful. And we think, why can't I stop? I used to think, why can't I stop? So I would say that part of you that has gotten you to therapy or has gotten you to inquire is really important, because that's your drive, your enthusiasm, your self-care, your part that loves yourself. And to just, when you're feeling down, remember that you have that, and go with it and trust it. And you use that to energize yourself, to keep going and to throw whatever you can at the OCD. Whatever works for you keep at it, but find that place, because you have it. We all have it.
Yeah. It's a beautiful way to look at it. And then let's say you can pick up that phone and call the 20-year-old you. What would you tell him? What would he need to know?
That's a tougher one. So it's the person now with the knowledge I have now.
Yeah. So telling myself, you who you are today talking to me, if you could get a time traveling phone to go back to 20-year-old you, what'd you say?
Okay. I would say, trust your gut and get get another therapist. Find what you need, because you know deep down it's not right. So don't be afraid to leave and find someone who is right for you, because when you find that person, you'll be able to get the help you need, and it will be so different than what you've experienced, and it will be loving and caring, and then you'll learn that about yourself, and you'll be able to give that to someone else as well. Yeah, I think that's nice. What I would say.
Yeah, I'm sure he would appreciate that. So, and then what's the next question? So you got a billboard in Manhattan. What do you want written on that billboard?
It would say, trust your instinct.
Yeah.
So David had said to me, one of the first things he said, this was my therapist after the bad analysis. Mm-hmm. He said, Jeff, you can read a room. And no one had ever said that to me. And he's right. I have good instincts. And my instincts were always through the analysis that this was off. You know, I'm not being helped. Why is that? But I trusted her. My billboard would say, trust your instincts. Go with your gut, because it's right. What you're feeling is right. Yeah. It always was, even growing up. Things my mother said that I knew were not right.
Okay.
That would be it.
And do you
feel... It would be in Times Square, and it'd be in LEDs. Neons,
yeah. And do you feel now you do trust you more in your instinct again more?
Yes, I have to remind myself at times throughout the day. But yes, I do. It's still hard to do, but definitely miles further along than years ago.
Yeah.
And also, it is more instinctive.
Yeah, true.
Yeah,
it's something you nurture and develop, right? Lastly, then, is there anything else you wish you could have said or shared today?
I guess I just was thinking that. Some things you had said. I think it was a few podcasts ago. Mm. You were talking with someone, and you were saying that you remind your clients that you have to keep at it, like maybe many, many, many times a day, right?
Mm.
And that struck me, because it's so overwhelming at times.
Yeah.
To kind of bring yourself back from the ruminating. So I thought that was really, that made a difference. I started to think about that, because it's hard, but it's necessary, right? That's part of the work.
Yeah, I'm glad that resonated. And obviously, we're going to miss it so many times, because we're human and we're going to get distracted. But it's when we notice we've gone off and ruminated, or we're stuck in our head. It's like kind of like I'll say meditation. But the whole point of meditation is to train the brain to come back to the breath, or whatever it is you're focusing on, or the sounds, or. Right. And it's the same with kind of rumination or any part of OCD. We need to keep coming back, because it's a habit. You know, we've been doing this for so many years.
Yeah.
That we're not going to snap it with a couple of weeks of therapy. We've got to constantly try and train our brain back to where we want it to be, not where it wants to be.
Right. So what do you tell patients to how to do that? Just to like breathe or meditation or?
Yeah, so there's many things. I do a lot with acceptance and commitment therapy. So there's various exercises as part of that to kind of come back. So it's not meditation, but it somewhat looks like mindfulness of like coming back to the breath or coming back to the body or using your senses. So Russ Harris, I did an episode with him recently. He talked about dropping anchor, his exercise. I do that a lot with clients, also while doing exposures, to kind of help them stay within that window of tolerance. They don't get too dysregulated from the exposure. And then they can stick and ride out the exposure, as opposed to having to do a compulsion.
Okay.
What else? The top of my head. Some of Michael Greenberg's stuff, I sometimes use that with clients. Sometimes, sometimes that can be helpful. I was bringing a lot of compassion now. So from compassion focused therapy, it's more when we're really stuck, we're kind of beating ourselves up.
Yeah.
And as soon as we do that, it's going to be hard not to do the rumination. So the more compassion we can bring in, especially maybe in your area, thinking about how the worry is like, this is what I'm interpreting as kind of effectively, no one's going to love me if I get this wrong, or who am I? A lot of that is that very inner critical voice that we want to work on and heal meet that with a different response. So it's when that voice is going on in our head, we can call it the inner critic instead of rumination at times, and meeting it with a compassionate voice of, this is really tough and I'm doing my best, or things along those lines. And there's so many exercises we can do that develop that relationship with compassion.
Yeah, I think that's really terrific. And I think it is important. And it's something I forget to do.
It's really hard. Yeah.
And it is, I think that's, now that you're saying it, I think it's one of the most important things we can do. Because you're right, if we're compassionate towards ourselves, then we're not so harsh. Mm-hmm. And that's a big part of moving forward, moving through the ruminations.
Exactly. Like I said, I used it for your example there, but also people with like taboo intrusive thoughts. You know, they get so much guilt and shame that I'm a bad person because I'm thinking all these things, blah, 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 blah. Right. And as soon as you're stuck in that, it's going to be even harder to do the therapy work. Whereas if you can start to soften up and be like, actually, I'm human and all humans have thoughts they don't like. And it just, these thoughts just make me human, not a bad person. And kind of softening and changing that narrative a bit to then allow you to do the work and to feel like you're someone that deserves to do the work, you know?
Right, right. Because there's a lot that we have so much negativity, I think, in our minds.
Yeah.
What you said something before about reacting to the ruminations differently. And I think part of what I'm starting to think of is, you know, this voice that's saying this, the thoughts that are saying, oh, this has to be better, to say, well, who are you? You know, I'm kind of talking to my mom or responding or to my therapist, the analyst, in a way that I was too afraid to then. But, you know, what would that look like? Because that's agency also. That's saying, well, you know, no, you're wrong in your way of thinking, and this is what's best for me, not what you're saying. I think there's some power in that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a good therapist should be able to take challenge. You know, my clients challenge me. Some of them challenge me quite a bit. And then I work with it. And sometimes maybe there's a deeper reason why they're challenging me. But then sometimes it is literally like I haven't been clear or they don't get it. And then it's on me as the therapist to be better and make sure I'm selling them on it, you know? If I think that's the right way to go. And obviously, So therapists should welcome those challenges because it's a dual relationship, and in relationships there's rupture and repair, and that's healing as well. Versus, I'm the analyst, you know, don't speak to me or don't, you know, that's not.
Don't tell me your thoughts. I know more than you.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's great what you said, because I've heard some other therapists on your podcast who speak about, oh, I felt I wasn't getting the results I wanted, was hoping for this client. What could I do better or differently, you know, to try and help them? I think that's so important. That's one of the most important qualities a therapist can have, because then you're in working there. It's not about you. It's about the client. And I think that's great that you can do that. That's really important.
Yeah, ultimately, it's wanting the best for the client.
Right.
And I said to some of my clients, I'm here for you as long as you need me. And if you feel you need to fire me at any point, you do that. That's what's right for you. Because ultimately, my ego, would take a hit, but I'd rather that than someone kind of stick with me and I'm not the person for them, you know?
Right.
As much as I want to be able to heal everyone, it's not the reality. It's not, I can't do it.
Right. And that's okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
That's okay. That's part of the self-compassion.
Well, exactly. And I think also what makes you a good therapist is being able to direct them to someone who is right for them. And then in some way you still take credit for their success because you found the next person for them. And
that's true.
At least that's what I tell myself. So
no, I think that's right. I wish I had asked my therapist, why did you never do that? And she said, I don't work that way. I don't know what that means, but if you have compassion, empathy and compassion and humility for your client, that's a sign of a really good therapist.
Exactly. With that the way she was practicing, as you said, very Freudian. And there's a lot of Freud's theories that I like, but that way, that old school way of practicing, there's not much compassion in the room. Mm-hmm. And then psychoanalysis did change to become more modern and it brought in loads of more compassion. It was more about the relationship. Mm-hmm. So that's completely different psychoanalysis to that, what you experience where, it's a blank, she's a blank screen. There's no emotion. There's no, I'm sorry that happened to you. There's none of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really tough. And for someone with OCD, then you're just even more in your head. And I'm really glad that you shared that because I think it's going to help many people hopefully stop some people going into that type of psychoanalysis.
If you're wondering, if you're wondering if your therapy is working, I believe that it shouldn't be detective work. You'll know, and you should be able to talk to your therapist about your concerns. And talk to your friends and family. What do you think? Am I improving or how do you see me? Yeah, I think there are things you can do because I do think sometimes people are not sure, if they should stay or not. And there are things you can do, questions to ask to find out. And hopefully the therapist, like yourself, will be willing to do that and find out what can work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think a lot more modern therapists are trained that way.
Yeah.
Thankfully.
That's good.
Cool. Well, look, thank you so much for coming on and being open and vulnerable. And I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Stuart. I appreciate it too. Yeah. Thanks for the conversation at the end.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. If you want to find out more about NoCD, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.